companies are always kind of promising they will offer you security from your phone, in your messaging. But what if a spy agency actually secretly owned the company that made the devices that promised you security? I mean, that is the slightly crazy story we're telling today. The story of a company called Crypto AG and the way and the crazy operation used to effectively spy on all of its customers.
This far less well-known story about Crypto AG is the greatest intelligence operation of the Cold War. Period.
Yeah.
Because it went on, as we'll see, for decades.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, it had, as we'll see, kind of really consequences which changed world events. And I think because it's only just emerged recently what was involved in this operation, we're still learning and kind of trying to find out how it did shape international relations, you know, throughout most of that Cold War period. And it is an amazing intelligence operation run by the US, but yes, also with a little bit of UK role. And also the Germans.
The Germans
make their shout out to the BND, the German Foreign Intelligence Service. I think this is one of their first appearances on the pod.
The Bundesnachrichtendienst. How do you
say
what does it stand
very
for?
Very good. BND.
Bundesnachrichtendienst. I listened to a German pronouncing that word a few times in preparation for this, Gordon, and the end is unintelligible
you still not got
to me. I still don't have it. So apologies to all of our German friends and listeners.
Also, I think the other thing, just before we get into it, I really find interesting is that it is about kind of technical intelligence and communications intercept and, you know, complicated things about encryption. But it's actually also based on two people and a personal friendship between two people, a spy and a businessman. And I think it also is quite interesting because it gets to the relationship between the technical world of communications intelligence and signals intelligence and the human world of human relationships and the CIA. And so I find that bit of it actually quite compelling as well as the fact it's basically telling us about security and communications and what we need to worry about today.
This time you were going to give us a lesson in encryption to start, because the encryption and the value of encrypted communications is going to really be at the center of this story.
Yeah, so let's cut straight to the lesson. Encryption means encoding information. You can stop me anytime, David. So encryption is encoding information so that other people can't read it, keeping your messages private. So we all use it every day now. When you send your bank details over the internet to pay for something, it's encrypted. You know, when you use WhatsApp, they talk about end-to-end encrypted so that anyone who intercepts it can't read it. There's lots of ways of doing it, and it goes back really to ancient times. The simplest way of scrambling the letters and making something unreadable, which, you know, kids get taught in some of those kind of spy books you get given, is to use something called a Caesar cipher, named after Julius Caesar, where you simply shift letters, you know, along the alphabet. Another version is where you use a kind of wheel where you have two little rows and the letters line up and you create your message on one hand, and then you look at what the wheel tells you that each letter corresponds to. You write it down, and if someone has the same wheel set up at the same place, they could turn the gobbledygook back into a readable message, right? So that's the simple explanation. But if you go back a century or so, just over that, you get the first encryption machines, which are being built, electromechanical devices. They look like a typewriter. You type your message on a keyboard, scrambles it with rotors which turn, which give you lots more combinations, making it harder to crack. Then you get out the message, looks like gobbledygook on a bit of paper. You can transmit it over radio, Morse code. Only if you've got another machine with the same settings can the person who receives the message read it. February 1918, a German engineer named Arthur Scherbius, I think it's the right pronunciation. now, whose other inventions included an electric pillow? So I love that fact. He is going to invent a machine which he's going to sell to businesses with a slogan: one secret, well protected, may pay the entire cost of the machine. Good salesman. And he's going to call the machine Enigma because it's so mysterious. Of course, it's going to get very famous. It's actually made for businesses originally, but governments immediately see, well, there's some advantage when you're sending diplomatic messages, intelligence reports, military orders, to have them encrypted. Obviously, where you've got secrets, spies are going to try and steal them. So where there's code, you get code breakers. Most famously, the team at Bletchley Park will set out to break various different types of Enigma in World War II. The big thing about Enigma is it's super secret during the war. You don't want your enemy to know you've broken their codes because then they'll change them and you won't be able to read them. But they keep it secret after the war. And this is really interesting. It's kept secret in Britain until the 1970s, the fact Bletchley Park did what it did. And if you want to understand why they did that, actually this story about Crypto AG is going to help explain that. Because the point is, after the war, no one knows they've broken Enigma. So everyone believes these kind of machines are unbreakable. And at the same time, other companies are building their own versions of the Enigma machine. And here we meet our first character, Boris Hagelin. Born in Russia, and that's going to be important, in 1892 to a Swedish family. And his father works in a senior capacity for the Nobel family, which have a load of oil refineries in Baku. The Nobel family, as in the Nobel Prize, David. So I know your president is waiting for his peace prize. You're waiting for your prize for literature, I imagine.
That's right.
As we speak.
That's right. Another year, and I didn't get it, Gordon. Another year.
I'll have a word.
Another empty spot on my shelf for my
It'll
Nobel.
Happen. So Boris Hagelin is, you know, working for the Nobel family. He goes back to Stockholm for his education, graduates in mechanical engineering in 1914. He's expecting to go back to Russia, but then you get the Bolshevik Revolution 1917. So that's over. The Nobel family are still kind of helping him and his father out. And young Boris ends up in charge of a small company in 1921 called AB Cryptograph, which Nobel are investing in. And this builds these kind of very early cipher machines like the Enigma. And he's tinkering and trying to understand it. 1925, he hears the Swedish military, so he's back in Sweden, have got hold of one of these German Enigma machines. And he rushes over to the Swedish military and he says, oh, hang on a sec, I can build you something better. Now, I think he's a little bit of a modern techie in the kind of fake it until you make it category, because the truth is I don't think he knows how to do that. I think he's, you know, he's just kind of guessing, bluffing that he's going to be able to do it. But he gets to work. 6 months later, he's built off kind of knockoff, slightly inferior version of Enigma, and he gets the Swedish general staff, the military, to buy his machine, the B-21. Business starts then struggling a little bit. 1932 gets the French military to buy a model, followed by the Deuxième Bureau, French spies. How was my French there? It's okay.
Très bon, Gordon.
Thank you, David. And then he of course, like anyone that was, you know, seeking to make it, he's got to go to the Americans. So he starts to sell late 30s. May 1940, he just about escapes the war in Europe, and he escapes from Italy, actually, with two machines in his luggage, heads to the US, spends most of the war in the US, and this is where he starts to sell big, crucially, including to the US Army. He's going to sell 140,000 machines for the military to use for kind of encrypted tactical communications, a deal for $9 million.
Probably like $80 billion today.
No, not that much.
You didn't do the calculation here, Gordon. Yeah, you didn't do the math.
But he's in his late 40s. You know, he's handsome, slim, silver, slick back hair, well-dressed, kind of looks like a successful businessman, not quite a tech bro. Wars are good for business. 1948, he goes back to Sweden, but then moves the company to Switzerland. It merges with another company and it's going to become called Crypto AG. Crucial thing is it's starting to build better machines. And he's going to think, I'm going to start selling these around the world. Everyone wants these machines. Start of the 50s, Crypto AG builds a new machine called the CX-52, which is a massive improvement on the previous ones. It's actually quite good. And it's so good that it freaks out US intelligence, who, when they see it, realize we can't break it. And this is the central problem then. What do you do when someone is building in the private sector high-grade encryption and offering to sell it to anyone? And that is the problem.
Well, and it makes me think, Gordon, it's not encryption. It's actually the opposite. But it makes me think of the Israeli software developer, NSO Group, that made the Pegasus spyware, which essentially was a zero-click exploit that enabled the user to get access to a target's phone. And that private company sold that spyware, you know, to the Emiratis. And I think they sold it to a dozen other governments that used it to sort of monitor internal opposition. It's something that's commercially available and that immediately has intelligence or national security sort of implications or use cases. And it reminds me of that here. It's like, how do you as a government or an intelligence agency deal with a threat in the private sector? And try to prevent that company from, quite legally in most cases, selling their wares to rivals.
And what's interesting in this case is it's a friendship. And that's where this kind of issue of friendship comes into play. Because the friendship is going to be between Boris Hagelin, the businessman, and another man who is actually America's top codebreaker. And it turns out they're friends. Now, his name is William Friedman, and he's described as the father of American cryptology. He's credited with coining the term cryptology to kind of talk about the science of secret communications. Now, here's what's interesting. He was originally called Wolf, not William Friedman. And he also has a Russian background. He's the son of well-educated Hungarian Russian Jewish family who flee Russia just after he's born, almost within a year of Boris Hagelin, and his family go to Pittsburgh. So as a child, he gets into codes. So he reads a short story by Edgar Allan Poe, which I think is called The Gold Bug, where there's a kind of secret code and a treasure hunt and the kind of people have to decode it. And that gets him into it. He's then go to work at a private research lab where he meets Elizabeth, a young woman who's also a code nut. She's spending her time looking for secret messages hidden in the works of Shakespeare and other Elizabethan writers.
Sounds like a perfect match.
It is a perfect match. I mean, they inevitably fall for each other and get married. And he's a kind of balding, quite dapper in his dress, often got a bow tie, neat moustache. Looks like a kind of crypt guy, I guess, if you want to be stereotypical about these people. Is that harsh?
Is that because of the bow tie?
I feel like 50s crypt people, that was their look, was kind of bow ties and dapper
yes.
dress.
I don't know. Thin mustaches.
Thin mustaches, exactly. Goes to work for the US War Office in code breaking in the 20s. Interestingly enough, America had done code breaking in the First World War, a place called the Black Chamber, secret facility in New York, which famously gets closed down because the Secretary of State says, gentlemen don't read others' mail, which I love. That's like such a
simpler time. It was a simpler time.
What happened to that?
Yeah, it's gone.
But Friedman's going to be tasked with rebuilding after the kind of closure of the Black Chamber, a new service within the US Army. It's interesting. He works with his wife a lot. And the first kind of traffic they're cracking is what's called rum runner traffic. Because this was the days of prohibition, David. Can you believe that day when the US banned alcohol? I mean, seems bizarre to you after our cocktail making.
Yes, that's what I was thinking the other week. As someone who participated in a cocktail making live stream in which I consumed three quite strong drinks between 2:30 and 3:30 p.m. in the afternoon. No, I cannot imagine
the world of prohibition.
Having my freedom to do that taken away, Gordon. Although that evening I might have hoped for someone to have prevented me from doing that.
So. Yeah, but yeah, a reminder, if you want to learn how to make some of those crazy cocktails, that I think the live stream is still available to club
members.
Oh,
it's very available. Yes, join the Declassified Club and you can watch us having a few drinks in the afternoon.
But anyway, this time back to prohibition, criminal gangs are smuggling liquor into America from outside the US, organized by radio using codes. And Friedman's wife, Elizabeth, works in the Coast Guard. And she and her husband will kind of crack the codes. His team have got a nut file, which is all the people who are kind of claiming to have built unbreakable codes and demanding $1 million from the government, or else they'll sell them to other countries, which I love.
You maintain a nut file on our club members too, right? On our secret squirrels.
I do not.
Everyone's got a nut file.
Every secret squirrel is valued.
Has a nut file.
But as the 30s progresses, you know, Friedman and his kind of army intelligence unit then see a new Japanese kind of code system called Purple, which is their high-level cipher machine. You know, huge pressure to break it as the war approaches. Friedman actually, at one point, has a breakdown and is hospitalized. But he's going to become a kind of core figure in American code breaking. And of course, he meets Hagelin in the late 30s when Boris Hagelin is trying to sell his crypto devices. And Friedman takes a look at them. He's not actually that impressed. Quickly works out how to break it. But the two men become friends. And I guess it's obvious why, isn't it?
They're both Russians. They both love codes and cryptology.
One likes making them, one likes breaking them. But you can see why. They're kind of two kind of nerdy crypt guys. So, yeah. And their wives are also going to become good friends. And that's going to last throughout their whole lives. And they'll stay at each other's houses when they go visit. So, back to the story. 1951, the US is worried about Boris Hagelin building new machines that they can't break. So Friedman, now working for the NSA, the National Security Agency, decides, well, maybe I'll go talk to him. And so that is going to lead to a dinner at Friedman's favorite haunt, the Cosmos Club in DC. Is that still there? Does that still exist?
It's still there. I've not been, but the pictures online were quite lovely. It made me wish I'd been invited, Gordon. It's kind of got this air, even in the pictures, of you're going to have important people sitting, kind of having conversation over these tables in this sort of grand dining room, hashing out really important political arrangements. And that is exactly, isn't it, what Hagelin and Friedman work out when they're at the Cosmos Club. It comes to be, I love this, it comes to be known as the gentleman's understanding.
Yeah, that's right. So let's maybe take a break there. And when we come back, we'll learn what this gentleman's understanding really means.
All right, welcome back. It's 1951. We're at the Cosmos Club in Washington, D.C., doubtless deep into our second martini. And Boris Hagelin and William Friedman are hashing out this gentleman's understanding, which is going to really have tremendous implications for American intelligence and really the intelligence apparatus of the entire Cold War.
Yeah, that's right. So over dinner, Friedman asked a question. Would it be possible to control the sale of the new machines, these ones that are super secure, in a way that only certain countries could purchase the newer, more secure machines? And now, Friedman says Hagelin sounded interesting. Now, at first, this is just a kind of gentleman's agreement. Could we kind of work together to control the flow of these encryption machines? But it's going to kind of evolve into a formal deal and then something even more intense and surprising.
Does Hagelin know that Friedman works for the NSA?
Yeah. And I think he knows what he's doing. I mean,
yeah,
that's what is interesting about this. He's not doing it even for the money particularly or for anything else. I think he's doing it partly for friendship and partly because I think he kind of gets it and understands it. So it's interesting, isn't it? Because there's no doubt he knows exactly what he's being asked to do. Because effectively, what he's being asked to do is restrict the sale of his most sophisticated models to just countries approved by the United States. It's kind of like, you know, export controls for weapons. But that's one thing. But then there's something kind of subtler which goes on. Because I think if it was just that, that would be kind of okay. But I think what they're actually going to do is discuss that other countries will be sold machines and be told they're secure whilst not knowing that the US can read the messages of the machines.
This, I think, is the or one aspect of the genius of this operation, because my mental model for this, just after having read a couple articles prior to us having this conversation, was that the CIA, the NSA had installed like a backdoor into these machines that allowed them to read the encrypted messages. But it's actually far more clever than that, isn't it? Because that might work for a while, but eventually someone somewhere, some customer is going to spot that and it's going to be over, right? The really, I think, diabolical piece of this is that the idea was just to reduce slightly the complexity of the code so that the CIA, the NSA, whomever, is still going to have to decrypt it, but it's just going to be made far less challenging to do so.
Because it still looks secure. Because, of course, you hear this phrase backdoor. But if you have either literally a backdoor or, you know, in terms of code, a backdoor, other people can find it. So the trick in this is to reduce the complexity of the code so you can break it. And to do that, you have to kind of understand how it's made, how the encryption works, how the machine is configured and how it's used. And crucially, I think, often with encryption, it's not the machine or the code itself, but it's how people use it. And it's actually a clue in the last line of Hagelin's autobiography.
Which is only 58 pages long.
Yeah, and most of it is pretty technical because I skimmed the technical bits. But he kind of ends again, goes, yeah, these codes can be incredibly complex. And you hear this stuff of like, there's 10 billion permutations of this and it would take a supercomputer ages to do. But he says, but these numbers are meaningless if the user does not carefully accept and exercise the instructions and does not make full use of the possible variations. The old rule is still true. The quality of a machine depends largely on its user. It's a killer statement, because it was also true with Enigma machines in World War II that part of the reason the Brits could break them was because the Germans would kind of have predictable words in them. And the key thing, you know, as he's saying there, is you have to follow the instructions to set up a kind of machine and make it work at the highest level. You got to follow the instructions. So here's the question. What if you even sold the same machine to two different people, but you gave them different instruction manuals? And it's so brilliant. It's so sneaky. And so if you use one instruction manual, you're using it properly and you're going to have a kind of unbreakable code, or close to. But if you use a different manual, you don't know that you've not set up the machine right. And even though it looks encoded, it's encoded only to a certain point where most people can't break it. But if you know how the code was made and you've got some supercomputers and you're the NSA or whoever, you can break it. I mean, that was one of the kind of geniuses of this operation. And there's even kind of secret marks on the instruction manuals to indicate, you know, which ones are for whom. And so effectively, the NSA is going to start writing the kind of instruction manuals for these machines. It's brilliant in a way, because you're manipulating the way people use it, but not in a way that's going to be obvious in the machine itself. Should say GCHQ, the Brits.
I knew it was coming, Gordon.
They're also aware of
this. I could sense it. I could sense it.
It's not just the Americans.
But they're getting everything, presumably, right? GCHQ, yeah, exactly. The Brits are getting access to all of this product.
Yeah, because Friedman goes to Switzerland, and he goes on these visits to Switzerland to see Boris Hagelin. When he comes back, he stops off at GCHQ, tells them what's going on. It's interesting because NSA are actually a little bit cautious about this. This is interesting culturally, I think, because NSA are kind of like, we like breaking codes and using supercomputers and computers to break codes and maths and all those things. We're a bit uncomfortable using businessmen to kind of manipulate the system. That's not their kind of comfort zone.
There's some agent handling involved here, it sounds like, Gordon.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't like it very much. So Crypto AG, I mean, it's crazy. They are going to supply different machines to countries, and also similar machines, but with different instructions, to countries around the world. And what that means is that more than 100 countries around the world are going to get machines where the US can read their messages. I mean, this company is going to get rich by selling customers compromised equipment. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? I mean, in terms of a business deal and an intelligence deal.
I mean, the customer list is, it's interesting, right? Because it's not the Soviet Union and China, right? So it's not the kind of big dogs. They're off the customer list anyway. But it is a massive list of very interesting other countries like Egypt, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Pakistan, India, Jordan, the Vatican, that's a good one. Argentina, Italy. I mean, this is the other, I think, fascinating thing, and has real echoes of the Snowden story, where, shocker, the NSA and GCHQ were spying on our allies, our dear allies, yeah. Like the Germans. Yeah. I mean, here, there's signs of this kind of appetite for spying on other Western allies at the same time.
Italy and Greece, yeah. It's Turkey, who are in NATO. They're all buying these machines, thinking they're secure, but instead they're rigged. And it seems like about 40% of the diplomatic cables that the NSA is decoding in the, you know, 80s comes from compromised, rigged Crypto AG machines.
That is an astounding number, by the way. That quantity.
Yeah.
I think backs up this point around it being one of the most important intelligence operations of the Cold War, because it is responsible for supplying American, British, I mean, German policymakers with a huge amount of information on not the Soviet Union, not China, but on basically the rest of the world.
And it's kind of interesting, because we'll come to later how this all emerges. And actually, the full details of this has only just emerged in the last few years. So in a way, we don't know the full extent of how that intelligence was used. But there's some really kind of interesting little examples. So in the summer of 1958, there's a coup in Iraq, and army officers who are sympathetic to the Egyptian president Nasser overthrow the pro-British regime in Iraq. And the fear is that they'll then move on to Jordan and overthrow a pro-British regime in Jordan. But Britain's able to move troops quickly enough to forestall that. Now, how do they act so fast? it looks like it's because the coup plotters were communicating with officers in Egypt, with Nasser's regime in Egypt, and the orders and the communications are going over these Hagelin machines that Egypt has bought. So you basically, you know what they're planning, what you're doing, what you can forestall it. So in this period, I think in the 50s and 60s, loads of countries are all using these machines. And the West is going to be able to kind of read the messages and then act on the basis of it. I mean, in some cases, we'll see kind of later, that's going to cause some kind of tensions and questions. But it's amazing as a kind of intelligence coup, what it brings them.
And the sustainability of this over time really hinges on the friendship, right, doesn't it, between Friedman and Hagelin?
Yeah. And, you know, there's long letters between the two, and it's all the health. Boris sends pictures of his wine cellar in Switzerland. They talk of their grandkids. You know, it's clearly like a real friendship. And as to the question of why Hagelin does it, I mean, he doesn't seem to have any qualms about it. I mean, Hagelin does say he's grateful to the NSA for what they'd done for members of his family, which looks like intervening to ensure a son-in-law had his active duty status in the Air Force retained, and a cousin of Hagelin's wife being employed at the NSA. So little favors. But he's not doing it for the money or for something big. So it looks like he is doing it for belief and for friendship, you know, that he's willing to go along with this. But in a way, that's also the weakness of the operation. Because in 1955, Friedman is actually going to suffer a heart attack after he visits Hagelin and Crypto AG's manufacturing plant in Switzerland. And he's going to start thinking about retiring. And he and Elizabeth, you know, they want to go back to working on medieval and early modern codes together. That's their plan. That's the retirement idea in the Friedman family, is go look for codes in Shakespeare. Although he's still going to kind of stay friends with Hagelin for all the years. And, you know, they stay friends after Friedman does retire, which actually I think does show this is a genuine friendship. It's not just Friedman doing it because he's been told to do it, or it's a kind of operational tasking. But Friedman's relationship with the NSA is also slightly breaking down. He's a bit marginalized. He's a bit left out in the new world of kind of computers. He's being put out to pasture. You know, when he's retiring, he's kind of working at home on contract. The NSA view him as a little bit of a security risk because he's semi-public. And the NSA is getting less sure it wants to be in this game. It prefers to break codes with supercomputers rather than deal with people, which I think is interesting, isn't it?
I was struck by this. I mean, why do you think NSA was ambivalent in this period? And we're talking about the, you know, late 50s, early 60s, as both of these men are starting to get on in age and Friedman is being a bit put out to pasture. You know, he's still, I guess, working on a contract with the NSA and hanging around, but he's not there anymore formally. I mean, it just seems, given the value of the product, I'm struck by the NSA's ambivalence there. I mean, it's got to be a bit more than just, we want to sit behind our computers all day. I mean, what's driving that?
It's interesting. I mean, I've been into the NSA, and it is a super secret organization. I think they are an organization which, now they've opened up a bit, hence the fact that I've been in as a journalist to interview people. But, you know, in the past, in the Cold War, I think the NSA was known as no such agency, wasn't it? Because everyone kind of basically denied it even existed. And I think they were so obsessed with secrecy for lots of good reasons that I think anything which threatened that secrecy or the truth about code breaking or what they did, I think they felt was a bit dangerous. And I think they felt maybe it was like Friedman's project. I find it interesting that they seem to be reluctant to do it. But as we'll see, the NSA's reluctance opens the way for another intelligence agency to get in the game.
And who might that be, Gordon?
Who might that be? Here we go.
Here we go.
The CIA.
Oh, thank God.
A new player has entered the game.
That's right.
Hello, CIA. You were waiting for that, weren't you?
I was. I do think it makes sense, though, because the management of this program is going to come down to how you sort of liaise with and help run this company and strike arrangements with executives in the company. And as we'll see, you know, if you try to scale this thing up, which happens over the course of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it's going to be more complicated and there's going to need to be more people involved, like chief scientific advisors on Crypto AG's staff. Like, you're going to need more than just one person who's really in the know. And that's going to involve relationship management and asset and agent handling. And I think it does make some sense from that standpoint for the CIA to be involved.
by the 60s, it's the CIA is kind of offering Hagelin a licensing agreement to pay him to kind of basically formalize the deal. And they're going to pay him $70,000 a year and a retainer and give the company cash for marketing. So they're starting a kind of relationship with him. But as we'll see, this is going to be just the start of a much deeper, much more interesting relationship as Friedman leaves the scene in the 60s and retires. But you've also got this second problem, which is Boris Hagelin, the other half of the friendship, is also planning to retire. Now, he's grooming his son to take over. Bo Jr., good name. He's a capable inventor himself. He invents a kind of pocket-sized cipher machine you can carry around, but actually has a little bit of a battle with his father over who gets credit for that. And you can sense from that there's some strains between them. Bo doesn't know what his father has been doing, the gentleman's agreement with William Friedman that's grown into a more kind of formal arrangement. The father has certainly kept it from the son, which I think is interesting.
The more we talk about the story, the more sort of flummoxed I am by Hagelin Sr.'s motivations, because I guess it's just one thing at a time that he ends up at this place in the 60s where he's trying to hand off a company that he's built in secret partnership with American intelligence. He's potentially handing this off to his son. But Hagelin Sr. has put so much at risk in this operation, but his entire business is potentially at
risk. It's kind of built on a lie. Yeah.
Built on a lie. He must have been so ideologically committed, I think, to this, and probably got some secret thrills out of it that he was willing to continue with it. Just it's immense risk.
And Bo Jr. actually goes to the US himself, and he's working as a sales manager for the Americas for the company. But the tensions kind of start to grow with the father. Bo Jr. marries an American woman called Edith, who his parents don't like. Familiar story. They think she's keeping him from coming back to Switzerland to be where the headquarters are. They think he's careless with money because he wants more. He wants to be a playboy, perhaps, but the father doesn't really give him enough money. It's the kind of, it feels like one of those classic generational succession stories. You know, the father has built the business and he's worried that the son doesn't have the kind of the work ethic and what it takes to kind of maintain it and to keep it going in the same way as he's built. It's an age-old story, isn't it? But you can sense that's part of the tension between father and son. And, you know, the father thinks the son's not really putting his weight. He's enjoying himself too much. So, yeah, it's Logan Roy and the family and the drama Succession, isn't it?
And Bo is actually a pretty good salesman. And because he doesn't know about his father's secret with the CIA, with the Americans, starts to sell really advanced, borderline unbreakable machines to countries that we would really all prefer they wouldn't, so that we could listen to their communications.
I mean, anyway, you can't blame him, because he's thinking like, hey, kind of goes to the Brazilians and is thinking a new market. And he starts selling in 1960, like the top machines. But the problem is, these are the machines that are not supposed to be sold to anyone other than kind of NATO and allied countries. You know, it's the CX-52. And so the US kind of freaks out because they're like, well, we won't be able to read Brazilian messages anymore. So then Boris, you know, has to kind of get involved and convince the Brazilians to instead buy a model that, you know, can be read. So the issue is he's due to take over, but can he be trusted? Not everyone is sure. US intelligence describe him as a wild card and wonder if the deal's going to survive the succession. You know, and that grows as the 60s progress and as Boris Hagelin gets older. And what's going to happen to the company? Is it going to be able to adapt to a kind of new machines, electronic machines? So at this point, the first signs of a new plan is hatched, which is that Boris is going to sell the company. And he doesn't tell his son who he's going to sell it to, but he talks about selling it. But the reality is he's thinking about selling it to the CIA, not openly, but through a series of front companies. And only three people are aware of the plans to sell the company: Boris, the CEO, and Bo Jr. But Bo Jr. doesn't know that it's the CIA.
Because we should say by this point, Boris Sr. is not the CEO.
Yeah, exactly. He's kind of stepped back. Yeah. And so Bo is already kind of probably annoyed because he thought he'd be the CEO and he's not happy with a sale. So there's a kind of problem. And then, 1970, the problem to some extent goes away because Bo Jr., dies in a car crash on the Washington Beltway just outside of DC. Now,
okay, you've said this in very, you know, sort of dark tones here, Gordon.
Officially, there is no sign of
foul play. The Beltway
is
very dangerous. People die on the Beltway all the time. But you wrote down, there are a strange lack of details on the crash. What does that imply? What are you suggesting here?
I tried to find out, like, tell me more about the crash. Who else was in? You can't find any details about it.
What would be an appropriate set of details to have on a random car crash in 1970? I don't know. How deep down in the rabbit hole
of a young businessman? I'm not trying to revisit my JFK assassination theories about the CIA having done it.
That's good.
But it is incredibly convenient that Beau Jr. dies. Now, look, some in European intelligence are going to wonder if something happened. Boris himself is going to wonder what happened with his son. He's going to hire private detectives to try and find out if there's something more to it. Others I've spoken to say they just can't believe the CIA or someone would have bumped off someone like that, even if they have the potential to screw up a world-changing intelligence operation.
Okay, we should say, I mean, you've covered this in sort of a gloss of paranoid conspiracy, Gordon.
It's the 70s. We're in the 70s now.
We're in the 70s. There's absolutely no evidence of foul play here, right?
There's not evidence of it.
It is true that it sets the stage for the CIA to take over crypto aging. I mean, Beau Jr. was a potential hurdle on that path, and he's now out of the picture.
So it's so interesting, this bit, which is how does the CIA, and we flagged also the Germans, come to buy it? Now, as we'd said before, the NSA had kind of got less interested in this, partly because their top target is the Soviet Union, and they're not using haggling machines, and they're kind of focused on computing power. And the CIA is kind of very interested in this. And I guess it's fair to say, isn't it, the CIA has always had a little bit of game in that kind of communications intelligence, signals intelligence world, hasn't it? It's not that it always leaves it to the NSA.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess a couple examples. One that comes immediately to mind is the Berlin Tunnel operation run by a friend of the pod, Bill Harvey.
Later involved in the JFK assassination, allegedly.
alleged by Gordon Carrera and other...
Sorry, conspiracy theorists.
Yes, I've added that to your nut file, Gordon. So that bullet point has been
added. It's a big file. But yeah, so the Berlin Tunnel was CIA digging a tunnel into the Soviet sector of Berlin, wasn't it? To literally tap the communications.
It also reminds me of an operation, Gordon, we mentioned briefly in our series on Adolf Tolkachev, the so-called billion-dollar spy. The code name for this one, I believe it was GT Taw, and it was an effort by the CIA to essentially, they would send someone down into a manhole outside of Moscow and place a collar on a communications line that the Soviet Ministry of Defense used. And so there you had this example of the agency essentially, I mean, tapping a communications line, collecting signals intelligence from that, but at the core of the operation is a human, right? It's a CIA officer who's responsible for maintaining that collar and all of the tapes associated with it. What is often not well understood about signals intelligence is how much of it is human enabled in some way. Like, you go through the chain of the operation and how the stuff is physically collected, and at some point there's a human involved in the process, right? And oftentimes the access that human has been, you know, sort of curated by the CIA, right?
Yeah.
And it's a natural fit. So there's more of a partnership, I think, between the CIA and the NSA on signals intelligence than is often well understood.
Yeah, because even if you go back to Stuxnet, the virus that gets into the Iranian system, at one point they're getting a human engineer to put a USB stick into an Iranian computer. You need a person to do that. And I guess that's the point, you know, about this operation, is that, yes, it's about collecting communications intelligence, but it's actually, as we've established, about managing people, salesmen, engineers, persuading other countries to buy and trust things. And I guess that's why the CIA feels more kind of comfortable with it, maybe, than the NSA did. Now, but the other question is, how come the Germans? Now, this is really interesting, because it seems like some Western European services knew or had worked out what was going on with Hagelin. And in 1967, the French approached Hagelin to buy the company with the Germans. But Hagelin says no and tells the CIA, because obviously he's got a relationship with them. And then I love this. The CIA director, Richard Helms, another friend of the pod, says to the Germans, if you ditch the French, we'll buy it with you. And it's basically, I think it's fair to say, the CIA are like, yeah. It's a good idea buying it, but I think we're the ones to do that. Because I think it's fair to say that the CIA and the French did not entirely trust each other at this point.
That's shocking.
The relationship with the Germans, though, between the BND and the CIA...
Is
much closer, though, isn't it? When you look back on it, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the BND, obviously, after the Second World War, Germany needs a new intelligence service, the old Gestapo, and the military intelligence is gone. And it's basically founded by the CIA. And it's kind of the CIA half running it for them. It's their people. They've got deep relationships with the Germans in that kind of early Cold War period. So it kind of makes sense, doesn't it, that, you know, CIA and BND kind of trust each other. And then there was other reasons why I thought it was interesting why the CIA would be happy working with the Germans. I mean, one of them is that, you know, you've got a company which is based in Switzerland, so obviously neighboring Germany, and you're going to need engineers and people to help. And it's a lot easier if you've got the Germans on board and you can send some engineers from Siemens, the company. It's a kind of German company which German intelligence can have a relationship with. You can send them over and to kind of deal with it. And you can have people going back and forth in a way that looks a lot less suspicious than a bunch of Americans turning up at Crypto AG headquarters to talk to them or to deal with it. You know, you can see why there's a kind of benefit to keeping it covert if you use the Germans as a partner. The CIA and the BND are going to go halves on it. Sale for about $5.75 million to buy the company, organized through lawyers, shell companies in Liechtenstein. So it's not like, you know, the CIA kind of on companies' records, it says, you know, bought by CIA, BND. And so all the staff of the company, Crypto AG, don't know who owns it, which is kind of nuts. I mean, they think it's some business, you know, kind of group, I guess, one of these shell companies. So only Boris Hagelin and the CEO know about it. All the profits go through Liechtenstein and then come to Munich. And well, I love this fact, the BND pick it up and they pick up a load of cash and they hand it over in an underground car park in Munich to the CIA, who were kind of running an operation out of the consulate in the city. I mean, you just imagine literally bags of cash being handed over in an underground car park. I mean, it's crazy.
You would think, you know, two services running a joint operation, there is going to be tension and misunderstanding and, you know, differences of perspective. But I was amused to see that the CIA thought the BND was primarily using this as a money-making operation for the service.
Yeah, the tension grows because the CIA think, well, the Germans just seem to be more worried about the money than the spying. But I love the fact the Germans are shocked that America is using this to spy on lots of countries that appear to be allies, including NATO members like Spain, Greece, Turkey, and Italy. And I just love, and of course, you know, you're the Germans, you're like, there are European partners.
A long tradition of Germans being shocked by spying on allies, which I think is total garbage, personally. They are very good at play acting, the shocked partner. Oh my goodness, we're
you Americans
spy on the Greeks
gambling in this casino. So through the 70s, the operation is still going to be very successful. So again, just a few quick examples of the success of it. Egypt is a big customer. 1978, President Sadat of Egypt taking part in the Camp David negotiations with Israel, brokered by the US, and all the Egyptian communications back to advisors in Cairo for Camp David are monitored because they're using Crypto AG machines. They can see what the Egyptians' bottom line is, you know, and this is described as priceless intelligence. So again, you get a sense of the value of this. Following year, 1979, Iran hostage crisis, NSA is reading about 85% of Iranian comms, although it's interesting because they're still taken by surprise.
And Bobby Inman, who was head of the NSA at this time, I mean, has said on the record, I think, to journalists at the Washington Post, that during the Camp David negotiations, that the NSA was able, through providing the transcripts of, you know, these diplomatic communications and sort of the back and forth between Sadat, who's negotiating, and then, you know, his advisors, presumably some of whom are in Cairo, that he was able to answer well over 80% of the White House's questions on sort of how the Egyptians were positioning themselves. So Inman basically said it was absolutely critical intelligence to have and so valuable. I also found a great story from this period, Gordon. Billy Carter, who is the sort of boorish brother to then President Jimmy Carter, and who also, Gordon, famously promoted something called Billy Beer in the United States. Did you ever have Billy Beer?
I never had Billy Beer.
I haven't either. I think collectors still try to get the cans. Essentially, he was using his access to the White House and the Carter name to make money. There's an intercept of Libyan communications in this period that show that Billy Carter was on Gaddafi's payroll as a kind of, you know, lobbyist, right? Getting access to the White House. And Inman, who is the NSA director at the time, sees this intercept and is like, oh, crap. You know, like, what yeah, what do I do?
What do I do?
And goes to the Justice Department and they approach Billy Carter and he denies it. He just lies. And eventually they work out a deal where he has to register as a foreign agent. But that whole chain of events is because the Libyans are using crypto AG machines.
And that's the thing. There's so much we don't know. I mean, the other bit that's interesting, I think, is it's being used a lot in Latin America. And in the 1970s, you get this wave where countries are overthrown by some pretty brutal military junta's and kind of dictatorships emerge where they're going to use repression against their political enemies and their own people. And these militaries that take over are using crypto AG to communicate. And I think a lot of researchers have raised the question, well, does that then mean that the US government knew exactly what these militaries were doing in terms of, you know, repressing their own people? So Salvador Allende gets overthrown by the Chilean military led by General Pinochet with CIA help, it's worth saying, and thousands are killed. Then you get the same in Argentina, you know, where a junta takes over in 77. People are getting thrown out of airplanes, dissidents disappeared, all these things. And it does raise the question, well, does that mean the US knew all about what these militaries were doing against their own people because they were inside their comms because of crypto AG?
Well, that's right, Gordon. I think maybe there you mentioned Argentina, which is going to be so critical to how this operation almost entirely unravels. So let's take a break. When we come back, we'll see how the CIA, hopefully, Gordon, manages to hold this entire thing together.
Hello, I'm David Olushoga.
And I'm Sarah Churchwell.
This week on Journey Through Time, we are exploring the story of the Gunpowder Plot of 1605, the story of how a small group of Catholics engaged in what would have been the most devastating terrorist attack in all of British history.
The plan was ruthless. Blow up Parliament, King James I, and most of his family, all in a single blow.
The series will tell the story of treason and traitors, of a group of men led by the charismatic Robert Catesby, who believed that the only option left to them to win their rights as Catholics was the violent destruction of the Stuart state.
We look at the story of Guy Fawkes, the nation's most famous traitor, from his recruitment to becoming the plot's fall guy and ultimately being tortured and killed.
Finally, we find out why this plot is still remembered now, 400 years later. Listen to Journey Through Time wherever you get your podcasts. And as a special treat for listeners, we've got an extract from that series at the end of this episode.
Well, welcome back, Gordon. We left on the cliffhanger that Argentina was going to almost screw this entire thing up. But before we get there, Gordon, I think it's fair to say that in the 1970s, mo money, mo problems, as they say, right? For the good folks at Crypto AG.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So in the 70s, it seems to be motoring along, but you can start to see the tensions, which are actually going to lead to the unraveling of this operation. Crypto AG, big company, successful company, 250 people. But of course, some of the engineers inside the company getting a little bit suspicious about things that they don't know. You know, where do some of the algorithms come from? Why are some of the flaws in the machines not being fixed? You know, it's getting harder to keep this all secret. And one of the reasons is the staff are frankly doing their job. Like the engineers are seeing a problem, a vulnerability, and they're fixing it. And interesting things start to happen. They're reading the Syrian codes. And then in 1977, the NSA complains, suddenly they can't read them anymore. And the reason is that one engineer from the company has seen some complaints from Damascus and he goes and just fixes it. He's doing his job, but he basically gets fired, partly because he's suspicious about what's going on. And, you know, the CIA is actually a bit annoyed about this because they think maybe it'd been better to keep him on the payroll, to keep him quiet. And you get other engineers who are kind of aware of something secret. They're going to start drinking. They're going to start telling their family, you know, these crazy, what sound like conspiracy theories that there's spies behind the company and people think they're nuts. The company is going to start hiring engineers, you know, one who's described as too bright to remain unwitting. And it's a woman who starts to build more secure machines. When countries buy these machines, I mean, they're not just going to buy them and trust a company. They check them. So they get their security experts to kind of look at the machines, take them apart, check the codes. And they start to, you know, have suspicions. And Argentina is one of them. After 77, the military officers who've taken over the country start to suspect something. And they summon the CEO of Crypto AG, who does know about the deal, to come out to Argentina in 79. And he's frightened out of his wits because he kind of thinks they're onto this. This is a kind of a group of people who throw people out of airplanes and kill people. And so he kind of manages to convince them, well done for spotting this vulnerability, we'll fix it. And of course, he's going to fix it in a way they can still read it. And it's interesting because the Argentines will keep quiet about it because now they realize there is this vulnerability. They think, oh, maybe we can use that to spy on the Chileans who are using the machines. So they actually keep quiet about the fact that there was a problem with it. So you've got this growing tension. And I think it's interesting because the BND and CIA realize they've got to kind of manage the relationship, and particularly with the engineers. And that's going to be the kind of one of the next stages.
Do we know, Gordon, how the CIA and the BND were interacting with the CEO at the time and like with the witting members of the company? I mean, what was the actual dance like? Because it does seem this is a complicated intelligence operation. It's gone well beyond the kind of one-man show that it was when, you know, Boris Sr. and William Friedman had agreed on their sort of gentleman's understanding. Like, do we know what the architecture is right now for how the CIA and BND run it?
I mean, the CIA are using a kind of the consulate in Munich, and, you know, they've literally got someone there who's assigned to deal with this. But the problem is you have got people who are kind of coming out of meetings looking a bit mysterious. And one of the interesting things is that the CIA and BND realize they're actually going to need someone inside the company to kind of manage the engineering side, because it's just too difficult. Too many people are finding out about it. So in 1980, they actually get the company to hire a maths professor from Stockholm, who's going to be given a CIA codename, Athena, because that's going to be their person inside the company who can kind of be used to explain away problems and who can know about the deal. And that's going to be the vital person who's going to kind of go out to Argentina and other places and kind of persuade them that everything's fine and you don't need to worry.
I was pleased to see a code name appear in here, Gordon, because I think so far you have downplayed the code name game inside this operation, because in the cable traffic, Crypto AG is referred to as Minerva, right? That's the code name. The overall operation is called Rubicon by the time you get to the, I think, the late 70s. But Gordon, it had a terrible code name at birth, which was Thesaurus. Which
that's
I find
so boring.
Very boring and bookish, and Rubicon is much more exciting.
I'm going to guess NSA came up with Thesaurus and CIA came up with Rubicon, but I don't know. Again, sorry, NSA people.
That's a good guess, I think. That's a good guess.
Interesting enough, the Falklands War, 1982, when Argentina takes the Falkland Islands, part of the UK, and invades and takes them, is going to be a really interesting incident in this kind of story of the explosion. I think we should do the Falklands War another time, because there's a really interesting
Do you mean the Malvinas Islands, Gordon?
No, I mean the Falkland Islands, David. And I think you'll find it's a very touchy subject for us Brits.
I just consulted Argentine maps to get the name right.
Like the Gulf of America. But anyway, the reality is that basically there's a kind of complicated question about whether there was an intelligence or a policy failure in failing to spot the invasion. And particularly when you remember that we're supposed to be listening to their comms. And actually, when the war starts, the Dutch come up to the Brits. It's quite interesting, and say, do you want some help with Argentine comms? Because we're in Crypto AG. Because it turns out they're also now part of the kind of a sharing arrangement within Europe. So more states have kind of got access through the Germans to some of this intelligence. Really kind of interesting how much it's spread. And it's quite interesting because some people think, oh, the Dutch gave the Brits lots of information. I'm reliably informed that actually the Brits didn't need it. And they said, thank you very much. But they already knew what they were doing. And there's a very good account of this in John Ferris's book, The Authorized History of GCHQ Behind the Enigma, about the whole kind of Falklands War, which, as I said, we'll look at another time. But it's interesting because a former British minister, so someone who'd been a minister in the previous government, says there's been an intelligence failure over the Falklands. And he says, how come we didn't have advance warning of the invasion? Because we were reading their messages. And he actually says that in Parliament. He uses it to attack the government.
Oh, that's poor. That's poor form.
It's a classic problem, politicians saying we could read someone's messages. And, you know, you can see Downing Street kind of goes, no, and actually thinks about prosecuting the guy. Because it's the Argentines, of course, now realize their messages are being read in the middle of the war. You can't change your equipment in the middle of the war, but they start changing the keys that are used to use it. But then, of course, they're wondering, isn't it Crypto AG which has done this? So Athena, the agent, the Swedish engineer, goes to Buenos Aires and he has to kind of smooth things over after the war and tell them that it's probably something else which has got cracked. Don't worry, it's not the Crypto AG machines. And weirdly, the Argentines buy it. They keep buying Crypto AG equipment. So it's so interesting because there's all these kind of signs. And yet, I guess countries just don't want to believe the possibility that their communications are compromised. So they just keep going.
The recruitment or the hiring of this Swedish advisor, you know, codename Athena, that's a great move, I think, on the part of the agency of the Germans. And actually, it surprises me that there wasn't someone on the kind of really technical side who was that in the know up until this point. I mean, is that actually, yeah. I would say that, is that true that
yeah,
up to this point, there wasn't someone with a really deep knowledge of the cryptology and the engineering who actually understood the CIA involvement? Because I mean, that feels like as soon as you have that, you can send someone to Argentina and smooth this kind of situation over by, I mean, potentially just sort of talking in circles around the customers and lying to them.
Yeah.
About
telling
the
them
equipment
it's safe.
That you're
yeah.
selling them. Yeah.
By this point, you can start to see the secret starting to leak out. There's another one in 1986, the Libyans bomb a disco in Berlin used by American troops, killing 3 people. And President Reagan, in the aftermath, he's going to launch an attack on the Libyans. And he's going to make clear that they're very confident that the Libyans did it. And of course, the reason is because they're using Crypto AG compromise to read the Libyan traffic. And he kind of says it in a kind of way which makes people think, well, maybe that's the case. And the Iranians, interestingly enough, are going to listen to that and think, hang on a sec, we're using Crypto AG as well. And then a big moment comes in 92. One of the company Crypto AG salesman is going to be in Iran and he's going to get detained by the regime. And it's possibly they're detaining him as a bargaining chip on other things. And he doesn't know about the deal, but they're going to interrogate him and ask him about Crypto AG being rigged. So they clearly by now are suspicious after the Libyans, after everything that's happened, going to become a big case. And people in the CIA and BND are freaking out about the fact this engineer has been detained. It's called the Hydra affair. And there's lots of stuff going on.
He's not witting, though.
No, he's not witting. And it's so interesting because that's going to be part of the problem, because in the end, the Germans are going to pay, I think, $1 million to get him out, a ransom. They try and get the CIA to pay up and they won't, it looks like. He gets out and then he's kind of angry and suspicious about something. And he starts doing all these interviews in which he's telling people in the interviews that the Iranians kept on asking him and interrogating him about whether the company was rigging the equipment and was being used for espionage. And it kind of shows the dark side of this operation, or the dangerous side for staff, because an engineer or salesman like him is actually part of an espionage operation, traveling around the world to dangerous countries, but unwitting. They don't know that they're actually working for a company owned by the CIA. And so these people are kind of being put at risk to some extent by not knowing that they're actually secretly, you know, engaged by the CIA. So it's interesting, the morality of that. But now the secret is starting to leak out. Journalists have been sniffing around the story. Back in the 80s, the historian James Bamford is writing a book on the NSA. He comes across references to the Boris Project in William Friedman's papers. And it's interesting because the NSA had tried to kind of scour Friedman's papers, basically to get hold of their letters, because they realize in their letters all these references to understanding. But then in 1995, Scott Shane at the Baltimore Sun writes a story, and it's kind of partly because of the engineers and what's happened in Iran, using testimony which says this is rigged. You know, he's basically exposing the deal. And the company says, ah, pure invention. It's nonsense. But actually, some countries stopped buying it, but lots of other countries are still buying the kit.
Still buying it.
Still buying it. It's crazy, isn't it?
It gets back to the point, that quote from Friedman's autobiography, right? Where he says it's kind of like a lot of this comes down to how the user uses the stuff. And if you just stick your head in the sand, we do this all the time with our phones, right? I mean, it's just you understand that you have vulnerabilities and
you take it for granted that if someone says it's a kid.
Yeah, exactly. And or even you understand you have vulnerabilities and you're just sort of like, oh, I can't do anything about it. You know, I don't want to do the mental lift to actually make myself more secure, because
I think that's absolutely
right. I have to confront the insecurity.
Because confronting the insecurity might mean buying a new phone, or it might mean installing a new app, which looks really complicated, and getting the settings right and checking what it is and being sure that's the right app. Ah, I'll just keep using the current one. I completely think that's right. But then once you get to this point in the 90s, it's starting to unravel because the Germans want out. And it's interesting why they want out, because I think they're worried about the risk to engineers, because they've got a lot of German engineers there. They're worried about it being exposed because you're having all these stories.
Also, every intelligence service in Western Europe seems to know about this, right? I mean, the French know about it, the Dutch know about it, the Germans are doing this with the CIA.
But here's the problem, of course, for the Germans. They also know that the Americans are using it to spy on people like the Spanish and the Italians, you know, on their neighbors, who they're supposed to be friends with in the EU, in the European Union. For the Germans, it's kind of awkward, isn't it? Because you're part of an intelligence operation with the Americans, who you occasionally dismiss as those, you know, people over there. But you know that the Americans are using it to spy on the people you're now allied with in the European Union. And they're kind of worried this could get very messy for us diplomatically if it comes out. So they basically decide we want out. And it's interesting because the CIA basically buy them out, I think, for $17.1 million.
Almost a 4x return. There you go.
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good if you're the Germans.
Yeah, not bad. Not bad. The Germans, I mean, they've been using it as a money-making operation anyway. So there you go.
And of course, later they'll discover that the Americans have been spying on them too. Snowden reveals that they're listening to Angela Merkel's cell phone and everything else. So I think they maybe shouldn't have been surprised.
Why are the Germans so surprised? Yeah, why
exactly.
Are they so surprised?
Why are they so surprised when they know what the Americans have been doing through Crypto AG that they're being spied on? I agree. It just doesn't kind of make sense, does it?
And you did a story on this too, Gordon, didn't you?
I did.
Illustrious list of journalists who have worked on Crypto AG includes none other than Gordon Carrera.
I did, 2015. So many years later, I did a story on it based on a whole load of 52,000 declassified NSA documents that got revealed that year. But it was funny. Just a brief note on this. What you found was, like, often they would declassify a ton of documents about, but it was often Friedman and Hagelin stuff, and they'd declassify different drafts of the same document. But obviously a different redactor had looked at the different documents, because in one sentence would be redacted. Another was a copy of the document in which another sentence had been redacted, but the first one was there. And so you could piece them together and basically work out the story. And the story I did back in 2015 was about kind of NSA and GCHQ spying on the world. And it basically revealed the deal between Hagelin and Friedman. But what I didn't know was the secret that the company had been bought by the CIA. So there was no clue then that the CIA were in on it. That was still very secret. What's really funny is I remember emailing the company and getting in contact with Crypto AG and asking them for comment at the time, which, you know, they gave me a kind of anodyne press statement or something like that. But it's kind of funny because I now know I was emailing a company which was still owned by the CIA at the time, you know, and saying, can you tell me about this past? But by the time you get to this point, Crypto AG as a company is in decline, partly because people aren't buying these machines anymore. You know, they're using phones and new devices. And so finally, in 2018, the CIA sells it off. It's interesting because they sell off the kind of the name and the company to some new owners who have no idea. You know, they have no idea what they bought and the history of what they bought. And it's only going to get, you know, become public in 2020 when, as you said, you know, Greg Miller at the Washington Post and German TV reveals the kind of CIA BND story. And the new owners of the company are like, what? We bought it from the CIA?
It does raise some very interesting and, I think, at this point, unanswerable questions, which are fascinating to me around when the sale was happening. who was on the other side of the table? You know, I mean, was it just a set of lawyers representing the ownership interest?
Yeah, I'm guessing some Liechtenstein lawyer.
That maybe also had no idea that the CIA was involved.
Yeah. So I guess at that point, you know, 2018, it sold off. 2020, news gets exposed. And at that point, the operation is finally over. But we're still kind of unraveling, I think, just how big it was and what the kind of consequences were of some of these operations and some of the knowledge that was gleaned from it. Because it's certainly, you're going for 60 years running comms for a large part of the world. It's wild, isn't it?
I mean, it does, I guess, raise the question of whether it would be possible to do something like that again. I mean, is there a modern parallel to this that could be happening right now?
There are some parallels in what came out in the Snowden papers where you realize that they were fiddling with the encryption. So I think there's some interesting stuff in Snowden where there were a couple of programs that NSA and GCHQ were doing where it looks very similar, in which different types of encryption was being sold for export versus for use at home, and where you could imagine the kind of very similar way, but now in the electronic world, that the complexity of the encryption, the how breakable it was being manipulated. And again, the kind of instructions might be manipulated. So there are definitely parallels there, although the relationship between big tech companies and governments is different. This was a small company that the US could own, wasn't it? But if the US government goes to Apple or to Google or someone, it's those are bigger companies than governments, frankly. And you can see that, you know, the UK government gets into battles with Apple about encryption over some of the same worries about having unreadable messages.
I guess an equivalent would be if a new, you know, let's say a company in Liechtenstein or in Switzerland or in some kind of semi-neutral feeling place, a software company had developed, you know, a secure messaging app like Signal. And if that app were to spread around the world and get downloaded on everybody's phones and everyone, you know, huge numbers of people start using it. And if at the core of that company, the founder and CEO were actually working for the CIA and had provided the CIA with the ability to have some leg up in how you actually would decrypt them, to be, that would be sort of a modern, I think, equivalent to this, because it makes the point around the massive quantity of encrypted communications that the agency, the NSA, Western partners were able to decrypt because they had this in with Crypto AG. Like, the quantity of this is so staggering. It's not like this was the key to the kingdom on Soviet plans and intentions during the Cold War, which would have been the absolute gold standard for human intelligence or any kind of signals intelligence, but it's providing a huge quantity of really helpful information about a lot of, you know, tier two or tier three targets that, I mean, still, you know, important to US policymakers. So it feels to me like an equivalent today would be an app that everyone's got on their phone. Well, the CIA actually has a way to read those messages if they want to.
Well, the parallels come with the kind of questions about what tech you trust. Do you trust the kit that you're being sold? And it's why some governments have said they're nervous about Chinese technology. Do you buy Chinese telecoms technology? It was the big row around Huawei. The company always denied that it was providing backdoors to the Chinese state. There was never any evidence of that. But, you know, that was the accusation, which was, well, if countries around the world are buying Chinese kit, then what if there is a way where, by their understanding of it, they could get into it? I remember in the UK going to a place where they kind of pulled apart the Chinese kit to look for any kind of backdoors and to check the code for any kind of backdoors, looking for the possibility of what the fear was with Crypto AG, that there was some kind of secret way in. So you can still see there is this kind of issue of trust in technology. Now, they never found any there, but that was always the fear, is that when you're buying your telecoms kit, your phone, the software for your phone, any of those things, you know, and this is where it goes back to the Mossad pager operation. Do you know who is behind a company? Can you trust the kit that you've got? Because most of us are not going to be able to kind of pull it apart and check the code and get into it.
And there's a related point to that on the evergreen value of collaboration between a spy service and commercial entities. right? And that could be true for purposes of just cover for a non-official cover officer, a NOC. Or like in this case, there's a fundamental piece to the Crypto AG story, which is if I'm the Libyans, if I'm the Saudis, if I'm the Pakistanis, if I'm the Argentines, I'm not going to buy encryption equipment from the United States. I'm not going to buy from an American company because I'm going to assume that that company is collaborating in some way, shape, or form with American intelligence, right? But from a Swiss company with a bunch of German and Swiss engineers, you know, like
Switzerland, yeah.
Right, that's a different story. And to me, it shows the value in a spy service recruiting inside a commercial entity, like in this story, the CIA recruiting someone in a third party country that can sell into a hostile state. Like that's a really valuable intelligence target. And that was true in the 1950s with Crypto AG, and it's still true today.
Well, thank you for listening. Just a reminder, you can join the Declassified Club, where you'll get plenty of things like bonus episodes, interviews, chance to kind of ask us questions.
An entry into the nut file.
Entry into the nut file.
The secret squirrel nut file.
The growing nut file for squirrels.
The growing nut file maintained by your intrepid co-hosts here. We do hope you join.
And send us a message over whatever encrypted platform you trust. But otherwise, we'll see you next time.
We'll see you next time.
Hi there, it's David Odeshoga from Journey Through Time. And here's that extract from our Gunpowder Plot series that I mentioned earlier. The person who's not rejoicing is Guy Fawkes in the Tower. King James himself came to the Tower to question Fawkes. That's quite an astonishing fact, that Fawkes and the king looked into each other's eyes at that moment.
And of course, interrogations at this time, I mean, we say interrogations as if they're just being questioned, but interrogations are brutal, violent events.
Yeah, and it's going to get much, much more violent. Fawkes stands up to the king in a way that actually even impresses the king. He's open that they plan to blow up Parliament. He said that the aim had been to blow King James and the other Scots back to their Scottish mountains. He says that to the king.
It takes guts. Yeah. But it's also not the most diplomatic thing to say to the person you've just tried to murder who, and your fate is in his hands.
Yeah. Well, I think Fawkes knows what's going to happen. I mean, the king was impressed by his obstinacy, that he would not reveal the names of his co-conspirators, that he was willing to insult the king to his face. And you have to say about Guy Fawkes, a man who'd been a soldier for 10 years, my God, he had guts. I mean, he is a bad man. He is a religious fanatic. He's not somebody I admire, but my God, he was brave. Mm. You know, you can be brave and wrong.
Yeah.
You can be brave and involved in things that are evil at the same time. And he was all of those things. But this willingness to stand up to the king, this is before the torture.
If you want to hear more about Gunpowder, Treason, and Plot, listen to Journey Through Time wherever you get your podcasts.